For the week of June 11th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 370, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
One would think you would have been in New York last night because the Tony Awards were last night.
They were. I never actually attend the awards. It's much more fun to watch it on TV, or in your case, not that much fun.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to be talking about that today, correct?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. You're working on 3 hours sleep.
That's true.
The way your schedule worked this week, you had to just shove in the show early in the morning at 6 a.m. where you are. You're tired. You're confused. You missed the last 10 minutes of the Tonys, and you're going to be full of snappy rejoinders all morning long.
I'm sorry. Wait, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
Well, I do know what we're talking about, actually, because this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to take a closer look at this year's Tony Awards, as we just mentioned. They were held last night. Hey, you know what? I would have known not to do the opening banter about the Tony Awards if the first line about what we're talking about this week were the Tony Awards. You're right. I must be asleep. But in any case, in a wide open theater season, which shows will benefit the most from Tonys? And frankly, do they need Tony wins to win on Broadway? Anastasia and A Bronx Tale and Come From Away said no. Although actually, Come From Away, well, we'll get to that. During our book filter segment, Michael will pitch the Bond film that got away. On Inside Baseball, we'll return once again to news about music streaming because, you know, 2017. We've got Taylor Swift perhaps using streaming to maintain a feud with a pop star rival, while Sirius lays down $500 million for a piece of Pandora, not the James Cameron Pandora either. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's entertainment news stories. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, and Mojo. And the number one movie is, in fact, Tom Cruise's The Mummy, $175 million for the launch of Universal's Dark Universe, or whatever it's called, Dark Horror series. It's a disaster.
Well, okay, so to me, the big story is the fact that the Wonder Woman, there is no the in that title, it beat The Mummy here in North America, which everybody is shocked at, but I think...
Who's shocked?
Me.
Nobody's basically shocked.
I'm shocked.
The tracking for The Mummy has been poor. They said 10 days, 2 weeks in advance, they're going to be sorry that they're following the Wonder Woman the week later. The reviews are poor for The Mummy. It was tracking poorly in North America. Everybody predicted it would lose to Wonder Woman, and it did. But
yeah,
it won big in China. Tom Cruise is a big international star. Sort of joking when I said it was a disaster. It's not doing well in North America, The Mummy, but it's doing very well overseas. We'll have to see where it ends up. They'd prefer, of course, to have great reviews, but it's just like Man of Steel when DC started their movies. Poor reviews, but it did well overseas and made a lot of money. You know, it didn't make $1 billion like they wanted, but it made enough money compared to its budget. Now, what is the budget for The Mummy? They're reporting $125 million, which obviously doesn't include Tom Cruise's payday and whatever mountain of gold they had to give him to be part of their, you know, Universal franchise. And there's other big stars that if you see the movie, they will reveal who some of the other big players are that are in this series. So they get big money too. So I'm putting a big asterisk by $125 million. That sounds awfully low given the names involved and the amount of money they would want to be part of something like this. But, you know, it started with $175 million. We'll have to see if it has legs, and we'll have to see where it ends up.
No, remember, we determined last week, Wonder Woman, she's got legs.
She does. She absolutely. Great reviews, good audience response, holding very well. It's in 58 territories, still has some big markets to open up in. It made $115 million over the weekend. It's at $435 million worldwide and counting. That's already about triple what they claim the budget is, which is fairly reasonable, of $150 million. And we'll have to see where that ends up, but that's clearly going to be a winner. At number three is Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, $45 million over the weekend. That has passed the $600 million mark.
You know, I was going to say, well, bad movies tell no tales either, but you know what? It doesn't really matter when you make $600 million. I guess you're not doing too bad.
Right. That's well below the $1 billion of the last two. Again, you got to wait to see where it ends up, but this clearly is not going to be up in that territory. At number four is Baywatch, That's not doing great. $15 million over the weekend. That passes the $100 million mark worldwide. It's still got a ways to go. We just have to find out how well Baywatch travels around the world.
Well, so far it's not traveling very well at all, but we'll see.
Well, it's only in 35 territories, so it's got a lot of markets to play in still.
Okay.
It just didn't do great in North America. That's a big problem because they thought that was the most likely audience for the show. That's a comedy based on a show in America, but it was a big worldwide hit. Clearly not doing great, but, you know. And number five is Captain Underpants, the first epic movie, $14 million on the weekend. And that's about to pass the $50 million mark. And number six is a bona fide hit, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, $8 million on the weekend, $833 million worldwide. It surpassed the first one in every category, and now they can afford all the therapy that all the characters need in the movie.
I was just going to say, you know, you said that it's surpassed the first film in every single way, except for, of course, that nobody likes it.
And number seven is the horror flick, It Comes at Night. Good reviews, low budget. It cost $5 million to make, and it opened in North America at $6 million. So that's already a success story. It'll end up just fine. And number eight is Dangal, the Indian film, the drama that's playing great in China right now. $4.8 million over the weekend, $263 million worldwide. And that's on a budget of $20 million per the New York Times. But, you know, that seemed awfully high to me because it's a drama. It's not a big, elaborate musical. And there's no big special effects. It's not a period movie. I'm just not sure why it cost $20 million. But it doesn't matter because that's way, way beyond that in terms of box office.
Well, and it still has a few more weeks to go in China where, let's face it right now, it is the only country that it's playing in and has been for some time.
At number nine is a movie that I have no idea what it is. How are you?
I'm doing okay, actually. Thank you for asking.
Well, good. The film is called How Are You? And it grossed $4.1 million in its opening weekend. The distributor is Multi-CN, whatever that stands for.
Oh, it's multiple in China, actually.
So it's a Chinese film, we assume. No idea what it's about, whether it's a comedy or a drama, what its budget might be. If you know, reach out to us.
Yes, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can find us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up.
At number 10 is Megan Levy. This is a North American debut. It stars Kate Mara, about a military veteran who works with dogs. And it's a stirring, heartfelt story. It grossed $3.7 million on its opening weekend. So not a big start for this movie, but probably didn't have a big budget. We'll have to see what the deal is when all is said and done. But a modest start for a modest movie. However, it does bring to mind the low point of the Tony Awards for me. Spoiler alert. Andy Blankenbuehler won Best Choreography for Bandstand, a musical about soldiers returning from World War II who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And in his acceptance speech, he said it wasn't until he made this musical that he realized the depth of sacrifice of veterans in our wars. To which I say, really? You had to make a musical to know that military veteran? I mean, it was just, you know. Yeah. I just found it upsetting and bizarre that you would claim that you couldn't understand the depth of sacrifice of soldiers. I'm sure he meant more than ever. He always knew they sacrificed, but it just seemed like such an asinine comment. Not until I made a musical did I realize how much our veterans, you know, good Lord. Clearly you didn't watch that. It was in a break to the commercial. Anyway, number 11 is Alien Covenant. If only they hadn't made Prometheus, this might have done better. $3.4 million over the weekend, $180 million worldwide. Beating the Beast is still racking up money. And then below that is a Korean film, The Villainous. $3 million on its opening weekend. It's an action film about a woman raised to be an assassin. It was at Cannes, and I wondered if you'd seen it.
I did not, no.
Sorry to bring it up then. And then another movie. It's not a Korean film, but it's a Japanese remake of a Korean film. It's called Confession of Murder. And it's about a cop haunted by the serial killer that got away. And 15 years later, a writer comes forward and confesses that he is the killer. But is he? Is he really? It made $2.8 million on the weekend. The original, I believe, came out in Korea in 2012. And I remember it because we covered it here on Showbiz Sandbox.
Actually, that sounds like a really good concept for a movie. You know, a guy haunted by not actually catching a serial killer and then somebody comes along and says, no, it was me. But then you're wondering like, I'm going to have to uncover whether this guy really is the serial killer and then going insane and mad while trying to prove it.
And running down the list, one more new film that I spot here is a concert film. You don't see that very often. It's the boy band Take That. Take That, Wonderland, live from the O2. It grossed $1.2 million in two territories, which I assume are the UK and the US, but maybe I'm wrong. Actually, I don't think it did open here.
I don't think so.
But, you know, they were one of the biggest, they were the biggest boy band of the 90s and a huge act in the UK. And they just sort of reunited for a second. This concert is not that. I don't think Robbie Williams popped in for the concert, but they did perform at that Manchester benefit concert. And Robbie Williams did pop in and join the stage with the other lads. So that was a nice moment in that event.
You know, I was flipping through the channels on Saturday night, and lo and behold, there's that One Love concert a week later on ABC.
They aired it live as well.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. I mean, by the way, NSYNC would actually have or NSYNC, depending on how you pronounce it. They'd kind of challenge you on that biggest boy band of the 80s or 90s.
Worldwide, I don't know. It's a close call. Certainly, they were the biggest in Europe. But you're right. NSYNC was big, too, as was Backstreet Boys. But there you go. So those are the movies out there. Some movies are having trouble, though. Wonder Woman blocked in another country. Tunisia won't show the movie because some young lawyers filed a lawsuit claiming Gal Gadot is a champion Zionist. To which I would say that's true. And also, it was pulled from a festival in Algeria, and of course, it's already been banned in Lebanon, three very tiny markets. But it's upsetting. They're basically saying we don't want to see a movie with a Jew.
That's pretty much that's exactly what they're saying. And certainly not a Jew woman, of course. my question is she really out there kind of, I know she's Israeli, but is she beating the Israeli drum?
Who cares? You know, they're basically saying we don't want to see a movie with a Jew. It's not that she's wildly politically active, because she's not, as far as I know. She's certainly not an extremist in terms of anything she said. So they're just basically saying no movies with Jews. Similar to the attempts in some in India to say we don't want to see any films in India starring Pakistani actors. So it's a vile trend around the world, and that movie's paying a very modest price. They won't even notice or care that it didn't play in Tunisia. But Okja is having trouble in Korea. This, of course, is a film that played at Cannes. It's being created by Netflix. They backed the movie financially. They had a big problem at Cannes, but its director said, well, thank God I'm getting to play my movie in Korea on screens like I wanted. But in fact, the top three movie exhibitors are refusing to screen the movie. Why? Because Netflix is going day and date with the streaming. And typically in Korea, you only have a 3-week window. You only have to wait 3 weeks. And in France, it's 3 years, which is truly insane. In Korea, they have a very short window. They say, we'll show your movie in the theaters if you wait 3 weeks before streaming it. Netflix says, no way. We want to stream it right away. And I don't know. Is that the right choice? This movie costs $60 million to make. Why are you keeping it from airing in its biggest market?
Yeah, I think that Netflix really has to figure it out, because they're either making movies for their platform, which is fine. They can do that. And by the way, some of them are quite good. Okay, Okja, you know, I was plus minus on it, but a lot of people liked it. Certainly the Ben Stiller movie, the Meyerowitz stories, which I'm sure Adam Sandler would say, hey, it's not a Ben Stiller movie, it's an Adam Sandler movie. And I'm sure Dustin Hoffman would say, it's not either of your movies, it's my movie. but it's the Noah Baumbach film that also premiered in Cannes. I thought that was a fine movie, and I would, you know, certainly recommend people see it on Netflix when it's there. Can't imagine anybody's going to go to the movie theater to see it.
Because they're streaming it.
Because they're streaming it, and it's not a movie that you necessarily need to go see in a movie theater. Okja, on the other hand, I could see, okay, you want to see that in a movie theater because it's, you know, a big $60 million kind of sci-fi type. It seems sci-fi. It's definitely set in some weird future. I could see.
I'm just talking about this from a business point of view. They spent $60 million to make this movie. Why not wait 3 weeks so it can be shown in Korea and make some money before you open it on streaming?
Because if you're Netflix, you will never say that seeing a movie in a movie theater is preferable to and maybe even more important than seeing it on Netflix. Netflix is the number one way to watch content. That is their stance. That is their position. And
then they
will
shouldn't
not spend
$60 million making a movie.
I agree with you. You spend $100 million making House of Cards. That they did do that. Okay, fine. It's more than one film. It's more than one show. And it's hours and hours and hours of content. Okay, I get it. But to spend $60 million for, let's say, two hours, 15 minutes worth of content, and then to, you know,
for a movie that's not going to play well in most of the world, and most people will not have heard of it unless it gets the publicity of playing in movie theaters.
Exactly.
And the Meyerowitz stories is an Oscar contender, potentially. You know, it could be up for screen. Noah Baumbach's won before. All the actors have been nominated or been considered for possible nominations. Again, you're squandering the opportunity to make more money and make the film more valuable once it comes to your streaming service by refusing on a case-by-case basis to say, we want to put this in theaters because A, we'll make more money off of it, and B, it will be more valuable once it becomes on our site. It seems a bad business move. And if I'm a filmmaker, again, I'm glad I got to make my movie, but I think they're going to be pissed if they find out, guess what? No Oscars for you because you made it with Netflix.
Right. Well, and I have a feeling that that's what's going to happen. I mean, look at, you know, Ted Sarandos, the head of content, basically, over at Netflix. He did not get into the Academy, and he, you know, wanted to be on the... Well, I think he might be in the Academy. He didn't get on the board. He
didn't get on the board, yeah.
Right, yeah. Now, you know, we're talking about movies from all over the world these days, right? I mean, we do it every week when we do our box office. So when the Los Angeles Greek Film Festival showed up here in Los Angeles, it's the 11th version of it, so I don't want to say it showed up all of a sudden, but when it announced its lineup this year, I actually said, hey, you know what, I'd like to cover that, because, you know, we're covering films from all over the world these days, and it would be interesting to see what it's like to look at films from a specific region all at once. And I have to say, you know, when you really, I went and saw a number of these movies. America Square opened the festival, and this is a film by, and I hope I do not get this wrong, Yannis Sakharidis. And it's a film that really, it takes place in Athens, and it covers immigration and all of the social ills of Greece these days, which are the social ills that are kind of writing the headlines in the news. And a lot of the films touch on this kind of stuff from, at least a lot of the films from Greece, they're really good, and they should be getting wider audiences. And I don't know whether Netflix or I don't know where you send these films if they're not all going to be in movie theaters. It would be nice to see them appear on some of these streaming services.
Don't you think they would or are?
You know, it's funny. I think as maybe eventually, but I think, you know, playing film festivals like the Los Angeles Greek Film Festival, Son of Sophia is, you know, it closed the festival last night. I couldn't go last night because of the Tony Awards, and it won the Tribeca Film Festival for Best Foreign Language Feature. So, you know, certainly some really good filmmakers are coming out of Greece. We know that. Yorgos Lanthimos, of course, is in Cannes with every film. But now some of the filmmakers that don't make it to Cannes, at least on the big competition stage, they're doing pretty well as far as...
Well, I assume any film that plays a film festival could be picked up for pennies and included on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu. I assume they are all getting picked up. Why would any film not be available streaming? Once you've played out your festival circuit doings and made any theatrical debut you can, at least in your home country, I just assume pretty much all of them are going to be available.
Well,
wrong. I mean, why wouldn't it? Like, they can't cost much. So I would just assume the services would add them to fill up their, you know, fill up the larder.
Yeah, I would assume so, too. Although I'll take a stab at telling you maybe why that doesn't happen. And, you know, partly that's because, you know, they may not have a distributor in the U.S. to actually sell the rights off. Or alternatively, they've sold the rights off to another streaming service. Or another, you know, somebody who's bought all the rights for a territory and who just isn't, doesn't have a deal with Netflix.
Well, who, I don't care which streaming service it is.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I agree with that.
Who is it? I mean, you're saying they've sold it to Amazon or Hulu?
Well, no, they've sold it to some distributor that doesn't...
There are no other streaming services in America.
Oh, no. I'm talking about an actual distributor for theatrical purposes, but they take all rights. They take theatrical, they take, you know, premium television, they take... You know, they take the worldwide rights for a film, and then they just never get to the U.S. to sell the rights.
wouldn't they want 10 cents for the streaming rights worldwide to Netflix or Hulu or Amazon just to help the bottom line?
You'd think, yes.
And don't those people send people to festivals? Don't Netflix and Hulu and Amazon send people to festivals to pick up movies?
Well, I don't necessarily know that they're sending anybody to the Los Angeles Greek Film Festival. A lot of these films have played in other festivals, and it's just a matter of, you know, this is all, you know, a bunch of Greek films all playing over the course of
a week. I don't mean every festival in the world, but I mean all the big ones to pick up a bunch of the movies, like the ones that played there. It played at Sundance and Cannes and all that.
Oh, yes, they're absolutely doing that.
All right. Well, maybe 6 months from now, you can look at the list of movies and see which ones of them have hit streaming services or not.
Yeah, I mean, according to one of the heads of the LA Greek Film Festival, six Greek films were distributed in the U.S. last year theatrically, which is, you know, kind of a huge rise in the number of Greek films hitting movie theaters, in this country. Certainly in Greece, maybe not.
Sounds like a good upward swing.
Well, I'm staying on top of Greek films here in the United States for all of our listeners. But every week, Michael, you stay on top of the publishing industry and you tell us what books we should be reading in our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. Michael, what have you chosen for us this week? Sometimes it's a book that maybe Hollywood or the television, somebody should be paying attention to it because it should be a movie, a TV show, maybe even a Broadway play.
Well, this is a book that Hollywood took a pass on all those years ago. They made a big mistake. I haven't actually read it yet, but I'm excited by it. It's called Forever and a Death, and it's by Donald Westlake, one of the great mystery writers. He also wrote porn and sci-fi, you name it. But he's a name that pops up in a lot of fun movies and TV shows. He's a grandmaster named by the mystery writers of America. He's won lots of awards, one of the few people to win best novel, best short story, best screenplay. He did the screenplay to The Grifters. He got an Oscar nomination for that. He did the screenplay for The Stepfather, which is a very memorable horror flick. One of his books was turned into Robert Redford's The Hot Rock, which is a nice little movie a lot of people don't know about. He's involved in TV, like The Father Dowling Mysteries and Super Train, one of the biggest flops of all time. But he wrote a long series of mystery novels under a bunch of different names, and he's really well admired in the community. And at one point, the Broccoli's came to him and said, "Hey, come up with a James Bond movie for us." And he did. He came up with a plot about a businessman forced out of Hong Kong when it transferred back to China. And then he wanted revenge and big international tensions rose and James Bond had to get involved. And for some reason, they took a pass on it. And he didn't want to waste an idea. So he turned it into a novel and then he stuck it in a drawer and forgot about it or something. And now the screenplay has come to life. And that screenplay that he turned into a novel is now getting released for the first time years after his death. So it's the Bond film that never was. It's called Forever and a Death by Donald Westlake. It should have been a Bond film because he's a really fun, clever writer, and it'd probably make a good property right now, so somebody should check it out.
Well, you know, when you mentioned the name Donald Westlake, I thought in the back of my mind, well, I wonder if it's the same guy that writes all those movies. And the answer is, yes, it is.
Yes, it is. He won a lot of mystery awards, just as Bob Dylan won a lot of music awards in his time and is still winning them, including the Nobel Prize.
Yes, indeed. Now, when we covered this story way back at the end of last year, we said, gee, Bob Dylan not going to accept his Nobel Prize for literature. There is no Nobel Prize for music, per se, but he won the Nobel Prize for literature, and it was a big controversy. The first, you know, musician to ever win that that prize, you know, is his work literature? It's certainly poetic, but is it literature? Well, Bob Dylan addressed that issue when he finally gave his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. Usually you go to, well, I think it's Sweden, actually. I don't think it's Oslo, Norway. I think Nobel Peace Prize is Oslo, Norway, but I think the literature prize is in Sweden. You have to, within 6 months, give your acceptance speech and give kind of a talk. And he literally was cutting it down to the wire because he had like no time left. And he finally gave a speech. He didn't go there. He just kind of released a recording. That's what he does. he gave like a talk. And to hear this talk, it's actually just very interesting listening to him ramble on in this like kind of like, I don't know, existential way.
I read
way.
Moby Dick and I read Huckleberry Finn and it made a lot of sense to me. You know, it's very fun. There's a piano noodling in the background. I thought it was a really good speech.
Yeah, so did I. I was like, you know, I would normally say, come on, Bob, get on a plane, go there, spend half an hour giving your speech, shake a few hands. But then I thought, you know what? You're a recording artist, and this indeed is the way you release your work. So it kind of makes sense, even though when you start listening to it, you're like, this makes no sense. But by the end, you're like, that made a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, he worked in some Homer when sort of at the end defending the idea of singing as you know, his music is meant to be sung. It's not meant to be read. And he says he hopes, you know, you get to listen to it maybe sometime in person or, you know, by listening to the recordings. And but he quotes Homer to defend the idea of singing as being a valid way of getting across literature. So it was cool. He rambled on about some of the most formative novels that he's read as a person and how much literature has meant to him and how it's influenced him, and winded up with a defense of the idea that music belongs alongside all those novels and things. He said, you know, people wonder, does this count as literature? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. And then he ends up thinking, yeah, maybe it does.
But it's meant to be sung, and I hope you see it in concert someday. In fact, I'm playing... Yeah, I was like, I love the fact that he kind of mentioned, you know, see it in concert, come see me, that's the way I make my money. He didn't mention...
BobDylan.com for the latest tour dates. No, right. He didn't do that.
He did not do
that. That's
cool.
And it's all online, and anybody can listen to it. You just got to find a link. We've got one in our show notes.
Yeah, I think actually the official release was through YouTube, because they basically said, okay, you know, here's...
No, the official release was only through the Nobel... like site. You're like not allowed, like they Dylan kind of interestingly has retained the rights to this recording, and the only way people are officially allowed to present it is by embedding the code of the one that was provided to Oslo. So it's kind of a weird little legal thing where he didn't give up, he's not putting this out for the world, you know, he's Bob Dylan, he wants the rights to this. And so there's some little caveats about you should only embed. So like on RollingStone.com, they have the embed of what was provided to the Nobel people from the official site, and that's what they embed. So it's not any old random YouTube thing. So it's...
Well, no. It's the official Nobel YouTube channel. Like, in other words, it's the Nobel channel
it's,
on YouTube.
The Nobel people, not YouTube. Right.
Right,
they use the YouTube platform and their own platform
Correct.
To spread it to the world. But it's not YouTube. It's the Nobel people. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I will have to turn to YouTube later today to watch the last 10 minutes of the Tony Awards.
Oh, you missed the end of the show. Well, you know who won, though, I assume.
Don't tell me, because I haven't seen it yet, because, of course, I recorded the three hours of the show, and when I, you know, hit the DVR button to record, it didn't do what it usually does. My TiVo didn't say, hey, would you like to record 10 minutes extra or 30 minutes extra, which I would have said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I lost track of what I was doing, and I just kind of, like, turned off the television after I hit record that show for me. I'll start watching it an hour in. And sure enough, the show ran long.
Well, of course it did.
Which I could have told you would happen when I saw the opening number.
No, it didn't run long because of that. It ran like 10 minutes over. It was perfectly normal amount of time for a live show. But I'm confused. You went to the Greek festival. You said you couldn't go to the closing night film because you had to watch the Tony Awards, but you taped the Tony Awards.
Yes, but then, you know, if I would have gone to the film, it was all the way in Hollywood. By the time I got back and started watching the Tonys, it would have been 10 o'clock and we're recording early today. You know, this is just, look, you know, my schedule is packed tight.
All right, so the Tony Awards had a lot of suspense. The only sort of givens were Bette Midler for Best Actress in a Musical and Hello Dolly for Best Revival of a Musical, and those both won. And the rest of the awards were fairly up in the air.
Well, so do you really think Dear Evan Hansen was up in the air? I mean, it was pretty much the darling child.
No,
really?
No, it wasn't. Absolutely not. The Great Comet had the most nominations. Come From Away won Best Director, and that put a fear of God into everybody in Dear Evan Hansen, believe me, because that was the show that might have stolen it away. It's a big crowd-pleasing hit, and it might have stolen Dear Evan Hansen's thunder. We knew it would win Best Score, you know, Best Songs, Best Lyrics, and it did indeed, but it was not a given that it would win, not by any stretch of the imagination. They were sitting on pins and needles, trust me. But yes, Dear Evan Hansen won Best Musical, and Ben Platt, charmingly, won Best Actor in a Musical, and gave the best performance of the night in the key early number from the show.
Well, let me ask you, how did Come From Away? Now, Come From Away is a show, it's a musical about a town in Newfoundland, or Newfoundland, depending on how you pronounce it, in Canada, where...
Newfoundland.
Where all of these planes, 38 planes, landed on September 11th, 2001, when all air traffic over the United States was ground to a halt. They said, all right, nobody can fly in or out. You guys are in the air. Go land in Newfoundland. And this town...
Newfoundland.
Wherever. They said, go land over there. Okay. And all of these planes landed in this one town that has 9,000 people in it. And they had 8,000 people show up on these planes. And all of the town had to take care of these people because they knew one day this story would become a musical.
And what's your question?
So my question actually is, how did that win Best Direction for a Musical when you had Jerry Zaks for Hello, Dolly! And you had Michael Greif for Dear Evan Hansen? These are two very well-known directors. I thought for sure one of those would win. And I thought, well, maybe they've already won Tonys for direction. Maybe the vote got split. How did Come From Away win Best Direction? It was his first Tony Award win for it. The director's name is now totally escaping me.
Well, he'd been nominated before a couple times, and this was his first win. But it's just a big popular show. It could have won Best Musical. You act like it was a given, Dear Evan Hansen would win. What it isn't. They're both million-dollar club shows. They're both grossing more than $1 million. Come From Away is a real crowd pleaser. I really didn't like it, but boy, it's making the money. It's one of the shows I picked to invest in. Because I thought it has a really low running cost, and I know the word of mouth on it is great. If I'd actually seen it, I would not have invested in it. You know, I would have wanted to not be anywhere near it. So sometimes, like when you're picking Oscar winners or you're picking Tony things, it helps not to see the shows because you maintain more of a disciplined perspective. You're just going on the facts rather than your personal taste. And in this case, it's a show that people loved. The audience loved it. They did the opening number from the show. It got a big response in the Radio City Music Hall. It's doing great on Broadway. It's going to run for a year or two at least. It's a big success story. I don't think the people behind it, the creators of the musical, are going to have a long careers. I think it was just a fluke. I don't like the show and I don't really recommend it. But if people come to town and say, I want to see this show, I don't say, oh my God, no, stay away. I say, oh, you'll have a good time.
Well, okay.
You know, it's that kind of show. Well, but this is the year where the shows have not needed Tonys to succeed. They often need the New York Times stamp of approval, or they need Tony Awards to get ahead. And that has not been the case for Anastasia or Come From Away or A Bronx Tale. There's been a number of shows that have really clicked with audiences despite getting poor reviews from the Times and not getting any love from the Tonys. So that's a big story this year. Oh, Charlie, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, another one that got basically ignored by the Tonys. And again, is doing well with audiences. So that's a good, healthy sign because you don't want everybody to depend on that one reviewer at the New York Times for them to be succeeding commercially. That's not healthy. So it's a good thing.
Well, okay. Christopher Ashley is the director who won Best Director of a Musical, number one. And number two, so unlike all of those investors who actually did get to see parts of Come From Away, you know how this works, Michael, on Broadway. They bring investors in and they do a little showcase of the songs in some black box theater somewhere. Or they
flew them to where it was mounted in Canada and they saw it there before they decided on investing in Broadway.
Right. And so the investors did get a chance to see it and then invest. You would have said, yeah, you know what? Thanks for flying me here. No way am I paying any money for this. Get out. Where's the airport around here?
That's right. So, you know, that won Best Director and could have won Best Musical. But some other winners were predictable. Oslo was vying against A Doll's House for Best Play. I was kind of rooting for A Doll's House, but both of them are excellent and Oslo won. So that was a happy choice.
What about Pulitzer Prize winning Indecent or Sweat?
Well, we covered this when we talked about the nominations, that it was down to Oslo and A Doll's House Part 2, and Oslo won. Indecent is, won Best Director of a Play, so okay. That was a surprise. That was a big win. She was genuinely shocked. She looked shocked, so that was kind of fun. And it was very well directed. It was very well acted and directed. I didn't love the play, but I liked and admired it. But, any four of them could have won, of course. Sweat won Best Pulitzer. But everybody believed it was coming down to Oslo and
Best
A Doll's
Pulitzer?
House. And it did.
Best Pulitzer? Okay.
It won the Pulitzer for Best Drama of the Year. And so everybody thought it was between Oslo and A Doll's House, and it was. But if Best Revival Play, August Wilson's Jitney. That wasn't a given. We thought it would be The Little Foxes or perhaps Present Laughter. Jitney was the dark horse. You know, there were a number of surprises tonight, and it was a lot of fun to watch the show in terms of who won. As a show itself, I was indifferent. I thought Kevin Spacey was exactly as what we expected. When the Tonys picked him, they said, well, we can't top James Corden and his elaborate opening number, so we're looking for somebody more sober and traditional, and we've chosen Kevin Spacey, to which we said, did you not see the Olivier Awards? Do you not know Kevin Spacey's going to grab a mic and not let go? And that's exactly what happened. He sang a 10-minute opening medley. He ended the show duetting with Patti LuPone on a Bobby Tarrin song. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, and it just went. And then they had like a whole thing in the middle with the New York Rockettes, or the Radio City Rockettes. And they brought out two. I was like, what are we? Why is this even in the show? This does not
because
even need
it was
to be
a
there.
Deal with Radio City. They said, you want to have the show at our place? We want the Rockettes on the stage, I imagine.
Okay, you know what? That actually makes sense, and I'm fine with that now. All of a sudden, I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense. but I would say one of the I don't want to say strangest moments of the night, but definitely one of the most kind of like eye-opening moments of the night was Jill Biden coming out.
Jill Biden.
I said Jill.
It sounded like Joe a little bit.
Well, Joe Biden was there to accompany his wife, Dr. Jill Biden. Okay.
Yes.
And she came out to introduce Bandstand. Okay. This is the revival musical. And she got a standing ovation. She literally walked out on stage. She gets a standing ovation. And she's the wife of the former vice president.
Which I did not know you referred to as the second lady of the United States, the former second lady of the, I thought, wasn't that odd?
I did not know that either until I checked Twitter to say, what the heck happened here with Jill Biden? Did she do something beforehand?
And everybody part of the Obama administration, and it's a statement of support for people who represent the best in America, as opposed to the Trump administration, which represents the worst.
Right.
That's
well,
what that was about, obviously.
And I thought Stephen Colbert's comments there about new show, it's opening in Washington, but you know, it opened years ago on Fifth Avenue off Broadway, I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, he said it may not, it was a 4-year run, but it may close early. We'll have to find out.
Right.
And he proved why he was a better host than Kevin Spacey. I thought Kevin Spacey was okay, actually. I didn't like anything he did. I don't like the filler comedy bits. I don't think and he interrupted, shockingly, the envelope winner for best musical with an elaborate stunt of coming out as his character from House of Cards. We're waiting to find out who wins best musical. They've announced the nominees, and then he does a 2-minute bit where he comes out and hands over the envelope. A, don't do that because we want to know what the winner is. We don't give a damn about comedy at that moment. And B, the show's running late. You could have cut it.
Yeah, that was definitely one of those things that, you know, there were a lot of moments like that. I do find it interesting, though. Here's my question for you as somebody who covers the Broadway feel. I'm Broadway industry, but you cover theater, okay? Do Jonathan Groff and Brian D'Arcy James, two musical theater actors, do they always have to present awards together from now on just to prove there's no hard feelings between them?
Who thinks there's hard feelings between them?
Well, you know, both were in Hamilton as King George III. However, Brian D'Arcy James did it at the Public Theater, but then couldn't join it on Broadway for its big, giant, you know, when it became
because
a huge
hit. Because
he had
a leading role in an original musical, Something Rotten. He
right.
was perfectly happy.
Okay, yeah, I just didn't know whether everybody's like, oh, yeah, Brian, we're so sorry that you didn't get a chance to be a part of that big thing, you know.
He was part of it. He was part of the original cast at the Public Theater.
I noticed that they're always giving awards together. They're always showing
always?
Up together.
When else have they ever done it?
I don't know. I'm sure that they'll both write in and tell me, no, this was the first time. I always see them together now. I'm just wondering if they're trying to prove that, no, we're really friends. There's no hard feelings here.
You're high. I don't know what you're talking about.
I wish I was high.
But I know why we're talking about musicals and drama and Broadway and the Tony Awards, not just because it was on TV, because it's big business and it does travel the globe. And we have the figures in for the last road season. The final numbers are in. 14 million people in the U.S. went to see a show outside of New York City, you know, on the road. They played in 200 cities. It grossed $981 million. That's Broadway on the road, plays and musicals. And these are Broadway shows. We're not talking about community theater and shows that originate elsewhere. We're talking about Broadway shows touring the country. And in that genre, that area, almost $1 billion in grosses, and 14 million people bought tickets. So that's a big industry. It plays the country and then it plays the globe. So that's why we're talking about the Tony Awards, because
Dear Evan
Hansen is going to come to a city near you at some point.
Now, these figures, we should point out, 200 cities in North America. We're not talking about the rest of the world because this is the data that we have. We would talk about
that. I said that repeatedly, but
okay.
Sure.
You very well may have. You know what I was thinking, actually? That's right. Ben Platt is actually actor who won leading actor in a musical. He's the son of Mark Platt, okay, who produced La La Land, and he's a big movie producer. I don't know why my brain went off in that direction, and I thought, did we mention that? We should mention that. So now we have.
Okay, yes. And we also mentioned Trump, which brings up what happened at the Public Theater. The Public Theater is staging Shakespeare in the Park. And this year, they're beginning with Julius Caesar. It's like the 50th anniversary of the Public. And the head of the company, Oscar Eustace, is directing this first production of the summer. They do two. And Julius Caesar, no surprise, it's almost a cliche, as I think the Hollywood Reporter said. But the lead political figure in the play, Julius Caesar, they're playing as a Trump-like figure. And in response, bizarrely, Delta and Bank of America have pulled their sponsorship of the series forever. Even saying we don't want to be involved in this particular production or whatever, or putting out a statement. There's no controversy around it. It's a staging of Shakespeare. Often public figures are done. There was a staging of Julius Caesar where Julius Caesar was played as an Obama-like figure. No controversy was raised. Nobody was upset. It wasn't an attempt to incite violence. It's Shakespeare. Nobody got confused about it. If you actually watch the play, you realize that when Julius Caesar is murdered, the message of the play is, yeah, you know what? Turning to undemocratic-like reasons to take over power when you're unhappy with who's in power, not a good idea, and has a lot of bad repercussions. So it's actually a play not about celebrating assassination, but saying, look at all the crap that happens when you do that. It's not a good idea to turn away from democratic values. So there's no way, shape, or form to distort this production as somehow something akin to what Kathy Griffin did. And yet, like wimps, Delta and Bank of America created controversy where there was none and pulled their sponsorship of something that's wonderful and good.
And you know what? In doing so, they actually shined a spotlight on themselves. And if you're wondering, Kathy Griffin, who's she? A comedian? For those who don't know, hey, see last week's show and you can find out what she did that got her into a lot of hot water. But now, speaking of musicals, I did want to mention this because I was kind of thumbing through Variety, I think it was. And there it is, Working Girl, the movie, okay, Mike Nichols' movie, that I remember going to the premiere of, okay, back in the 80s. It's becoming a musical with songs by Cyndi Lauper. And looking at this story, I looked at the picture of Harrison Ford, who stars in the movie along with Melanie Griffith and Sigourney Weaver. I looked at the picture and went, oh my God, I think I look older than Harrison Ford does in this photo.
Well, that's 30 years ago. Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, no, that's coming as a musical. Cyndi Lauper did Kinky Boots. I wasn't a fan of that show, but it's been a big, big hit. And she's a great choice for Working Girl because, you know, she's the Jersey sort of, you know, the blue-collar gal coming to the big city. So she seems a natural for it. Hopefully she'll write some better songs and I'll be able to get excited by it. But that's a big project. And would I invest in it? I don't know. Sight unseen, you'd have to say, well, seems like a safe bet because it's a known property. Cyndi Lauper has it. But you never know. These things are complicated.
Wait a second. Didn't we do a whole thing where it was like, invest or not invest?
We certainly did. And let's see how I did because the season has ended. You know, I placed my bets in January about the shows coming out this season. And the season is over. And we sort of know who's going to work probably pretty well. I did invest in Come From Away, Sight Unseen. And that definitely has paid off. I also invested in The Play That Goes Wrong. That's looking a little iffier. I did invest in War Paint. That's probably not a good choice. Now, having seen the show and seen how it's done, it's probably not going to be a big player on the road. We'll have to see. So the road is where we always expected it to work. So the jury is still out on that one, but that'll take years to find out. Groundhog Day, I invested in that, and it's doing pretty good. It'll probably be okay. And, of course, I invested in Hello, Dolly. I turned my back on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Anastasia, and Bandstand. And I sure wish I'd invested in Charlie and Anastasia. That would have definitely made me money. And finally, I invested in A Doll's House Part 2. I did it purely for love. And actually, the show's going to turn into a hit. The cast now is going to be gone soon, but they've extended the show through next year. They'll have a new cast in there. I forgot how well Lucas Nath, the young playwright, how well his shows do on the road. And this is a small play with one set and four actors. two men and two women of varying ages. So he's actually a big guy in regional theater. If you've invested in this show and have a piece of it on the road and a piece in future productions for community theater, like you should, you're going to make money on that one. So that was a real roll of the dice done out of love, which is why most investments are done, and it paid off.
And this is A Doll's House Part 2.
Part 2, that's right. The hilarious sequel to A Doll's House Part 1.
I noticed that you avoided investing in Amelie, which probably was a good move.
Yes, it was.
I don't know. I guess, look, it stars, what's her name?
It's closed.
Philippa Sue. And yeah, I guess it was kind of, I mean, was that a big deal when it closed on Broadway? Or did nobody, people went, yeah, no, we weren't expecting that to do much?
I'm not sure how to answer that. Nobody opens a show on Broadway thinking it'll flop. It was a show that people were kind of curious about. It had opened, you know, in L.A., and so people had a sense of what it was like, and they were kind of like, hmm. And so they were, you know, the eyebrows were raised as to whether it was going to work. I don't think anybody was shocked that it closed early. It just did not, you know, poor reviews, not a good show. It seemed like an odd choice to begin with, and it didn't work.
Yeah, well, you know what does work? Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
More politics.
Yes, our first story, the testimony of Jim Comey, or is it James Comey? Well,
James.
He testified, the former FBI director testified before the Senate, and that testimony, that moment in time dominated media last week. His testimony reached some 20 million viewers on television, though the actual number is probably higher thanks to its widespread availability via streaming and in public places like airports and bars, where lawyers reportedly did shots every time they felt Comey outlined an impeachable offense by Trump. Okay, we're making that last bit up, but it remains a bit of a puzzle why trade papers like Variety and The Hollywood Reporter sent out constant email alerts about this political issue, not to mention live streaming testimony on their sites. Heck, Entertainment Weekly was live streaming the testimony. I, too, felt the same. I was like, why? Who cares? The New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, fine. But The Hollywood Reporter, it made no sense. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I don't understand why they're giving up their real estate. If you go to Entertainment Weekly, I'm assuming you want to get away from the Comey hearings. So I don't know why they're live streaming it. Maybe they think it just doesn't hurt them to do it, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Well, it hurts their brand. To me, it's annoying. It costs infrastructure and time. I just don't get it.
I don't get it either. And frankly, part of my problem with this whole thing, and I mean the Comey hearings, and look, if a crime has been committed, and we certainly believe that, the U.S. electoral process was...
I'm talking about sites covering it.
No, I understand that. And my point is that it's become a circus at this point. And having an entertainment trade publication cover it, there's no need. It's already gotten way too much out of control enough.
You think it's out of control? I'm glad the hearings happened, and I'm glad a lot of people watched, and I'm glad there's a lot of attention to it. Just like Watergate was a circus, I guess, to use your words, I just don't see why Entertainment Weekly is streaming it.
Right.
I'm
agreeing with you. I'm agreeing with you on that, and I guess I'm saying, it's an entertainment trade publication. It's not a political news publication. And so Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Entertainment Weekly don't need to be touching.
Stop covering it.
Yes. I think we're agreeing and saying it in different ways.
Okay.
Now, Michael, I know you know the answer to this. What's one of the largest bookstore chains in the U.S.? By the end of the year, it will be, believe it or not, Amazon. That's actually not saying much, because by the end of 2017, they may have 13 physical stores in the U.S., including two or three in New York City alone. Turns out that will put you in the top five of bookstore chains, since Barnes & Noble is down to 634 stores. BAM, or Books A Million, has 260. A chain called Half Price Books has 121. And Book World is fourth with just 48. That's a far cry from the days of yore when Barnes & Noble battled Borders, while mall chains like B. Dalton's and Walden Books and Little Professor could be found all over the country. Chain stores total about 1,000 locations, and that's down 50% from just 2011. That's shocking to me. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Yeah, the total number of chain stores is shocking to me. I think that's a big deal. And I think that's why you're seeing Amazon open their physical locations. They want to showcase books. This is a play just to say, hey, people want to glance at books and then buy them online. That's fine. But someone's got to showcase them. And these stores are disappearing, so we're going to have to do it. That seems to be the play here.
Well, a couple of points here. One has nothing to do with books at all. So I'm going to start there. And that is that, you know, we talk a lot about in this country, in North America, oh, the coal miners have lost their jobs. There's 80,000 people working in coal mining today, 80,000. Since November of last year, more than 80,000 people have lost their jobs in retail. Why? Because Macy's is going out of business. Sears is going out of business. Lots of
Macy's is not going out of business.
Well, okay. Yes, you're right. They're closing stores down. Yeah. Lots of malls are closing or kind of downsizing. So there are a lot of people becoming unemployed in the retail space. We never talk about that. But now back to, you know, the topic at hand, Amazon and their bookstores. There was an article in the New Yorker about how these bookstores, one of which, as you mentioned, Michael, has opened in New York City in the Time Warner Center. They said, look, this is not a store for people who actually read books. You know, Hemingway, they've got two books by Hemingway. That's it. Not you know, the guy wrote, you know, lots of books, some of which were, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners or Nobel Prize winners. They've got two. And nobody, like one or two authors, have three books that they've put on shelves. And they said, look, this is a bookstore put together by algorithms. It's not a bookstore for people to walk into and actually discover a new book or pick up an old classic.
Well, I disagree, because this is a bookstore akin to B. Dalton's and Walden Books and The Little Professor, which were mall store chains or airport chains that people walked in to look at the latest releases. It was not an in-depth 100,000 titles like the mega stores from Barnes & Noble and Borders. It's a place where you go to see the latest releases, and that's exactly what this is. It is about mining the data of what books they're looking at. That's helpful to Amazon, but it's about new releases. Not all bookstores have to have, you know, 500,000 copies of every book ever written. Some are just the latest new releases, like that airport bookstore. You don't find Hemingway in there. You find the latest new releases, and that's what these stores are about. Saying, oh, you will discover books that are popular on our site that have got great reviews from our readers. They're new books. They've come out recently. They don't have the depth of copy that your library or a really great indie store will have, but that's not what they're about. They're about the latest new releases. It's a valid type of store. It is about people who like to read. They're just people grabbing the latest, newest book. If they want Hemingway, they know to go to Amazon.com, or if they're lucky enough and they have a big mega store, or go to their local library.
Well, you know, it's funny because my daughter wanted a book, and we were at a Barnes & Noble around the corner from us, and I kind of said, well, I wonder how much this new book is, and it's like a six-month-old book. How much is it on Amazon? It was literally 50% of the price of...
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, well, I don't know whether Amazon is just because it's a new book and they know a lot of people are going to want it. They're basically saying, yeah, you can go to Barnes & Noble and pay twice the price as you can get here on Amazon, and whether they're using that as a loss leader to effectively torpedo Barnes & Noble. But there is...
No. I bet BarnesandNoble.com had it off for 30 or 40% less than you'd pay in the store.
No, oh, well, then that's...
Yeah, no, I bought George Martin's last book in the Game of Thrones series at Barnes & Noble in person and felt like an idiot because I was paying 35% more than if I'd ordered it from BarnesandNoble.com.
Well, now, since we're on books, in a triumph of free speech, rabble-rouser Milo Yiannopoulos is taking the book Simon & Schuster paid for and then killed... and is self-publishing it. On July 4th, Strike Up the Band, titled Dangerous Milo. The galleys have yet to be seen or reviewed by any third-party outlet. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's exactly what should have happened. You know, somebody else was going to publish it, and why not self-publish it? You'll make more money off it. You've already got the name out there. It's easy to do. You don't need to get in stores. Most people will just grab an e-galley anyway. So, you know, why not?
Well, here's a question. So did, you know, Simon & Schuster paid $250,000 for the book. Did he have to return any of that money?
No, certainly not.
All right.
Just because they decided to kill it for no good reason, you know. And they might have tried to challenge him with a morals clause or something, saying, hey, we didn't know you were supporting pedophilia, but they probably just washed their hands of it and walked away.
The California crackdown on shady casting director workshops is bearing fruit. Those workshops promise aspiring or perhaps deluded actors that if they pay a fee, they'll be able to attend workshops overseen by casting directors who work on such and such a show at CBS and such and such a show on Netflix and so on. In other words, you can pay to audition, or at least that's the implied promise. Well, LA has been filing lawsuits, and now they've struck a plea bargain deal with the owner of Actors Alley. The founders of the workshop pled no contest to three misdemeanors, must do community service or spend 10 days in jail, and are banned from working in this field for the three years that they're on probation. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop in a way. I mean, misdemeanors, I guess that's the most they could charge them with, and I guess it's hard to prove in court, and that's why they're going with what feels kind of like a slap on the wrist. I mean, I guess 3 years probation, but then they can go back to working in the business in the area that they're in. Why not a lifetime ban? But I don't know. At least they've shut the shops down. They've sent out the message that it's not good. You shouldn't be doing this. And that's the most important thing.
Well, and they've also publicized the fact that people do this. Okay. That hey, these workshops are out there. They're really not doing much. So when you Google this, okay, you'll actually, you know, yeah. If you're an actor, you'll go, oh, wait, maybe these workshops aren't such, you know, maybe they're
such
not
a good idea.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, just as one celebrity gets out of hot water for their dumb comments, another steps right in. HBO's Bill Maher went on air and apologized for his cavalier usage of a racial epithet during his show a week earlier. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the former basketball player and now Hollywood reporter, columnist, was one of many who weighed in, saying it was stupid of Bill Maher and shouldn't have been done, but Maher didn't deserve to be fired from his HBO show. For one thing, Abdul-Jabbar said, you should look at the intent, and Maher was not speaking in hate at a black person. Ice-T said Maher should shut up when thinking of using the N-word. Other celebs might want to just put down the Twitter, okay? Nobody should be on Twitter, at least certain celebrities. CNN's Reza Aslan called President Trump a piece of doo-doo. Okay, he used another word. After Trump used a terrorist attack in London to belittle that city's Muslim mayor and tout his own legislation, Aslan soon apologized, but not soon enough for CNN, which canceled season 2 of his documentary series Believer. Big deal or big whoop?
Wow, we just can't seem to get away from politics. It's affecting every TV show. It's affecting Broadway, everywhere we turn. I think maybe that's why
The Hollywood Reporter and Variety are covering it.
Well, that makes sense in this context to cover this.
Yeah.
A TV show canceled or whatever. It just doesn't make sense why they're sending out alerts about political news breaking from Washington that doesn't affect the entertainment industry. I think that's a big whoop in context. I guess the best thing is I was tempted to say, you know, CNN overreacted again. He's not a journalist. He's doing a show, you know, whatever. It's his personal Twitter account. It was intemperate words. He shouldn't have said it. I guess the main message is what our former co-host Karen Woodward would say. Don't do your own Twitter account. Let a responsible adult be in charge of it for you.
And by the way, that advice goes all the way up to the highest echelons of our government.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I had to kind of remind myself who Reza Aslan was. And in his apology statement, he did say, look, I'm not a journalist. OK, I never said I was a journalist. I never pretended to be a journalist. I'm a guy who, you know, I'm a theologist. OK, I study world religions and that's what my show is about. And CNN wants to be a place for unbiased journalism. Obviously, by doing what I did, I became biased, and that's not good for CNN. I agree. And so he was actually like, you know, I can see why CNN would be upset with me, and maybe we should part ways. And to which I would say, well, it's not really your decision anymore. So in any case, even enemies can become friends when there's money to be made. After years of wrangling, Apple TV is adding the Amazon TV app to its offerings for, you know, Apple TV. Interestingly, a survey of millennials showed they had trouble identifying which networks were responsible for which shows, except for Netflix. They scored terribly on which show was done by which TV channel, but did worst of all on shows produced by Amazon. Apple, at the same time, has launched their first TV content, specifically the Shark Tank-like business show, Planet of the Apps. And that's not apes. I'm not mispronouncing it. It's apps, APPS, which follows app developers as they try to convince a celeb panel their app deserves backing. Big deal or big whoop?
App must not kill app. I think the millennials, they got the shows right that were on Netflix, like Orange is the New Black and House of Cards. I think that's only because that was their only guess. What show is The Good Wife on Netflix? What show is Netflix. Netflix. It's all on Netflix. I don't know. Netflix. So there you go. So is this a big deal? It is a big deal that they've launched content. It's a first step. They're going to do a lot more because they got a lot of money. Why wouldn't they? It brings people to your world. And that's what Apple is about. And they're making more money on content. So why wouldn't they create some of their own?
Well, and you know what? A couple things. You mentioned this Netflix thing that Netflix was the only choice. You know, look, they could have been saying, you know, 5-6 years ago, they would have been saying BitTorrent.
Yeah.
You know, so at least Netflix, somebody's paying for Netflix. I mean, granted, it might only be one out of the five people who actually watch the show on Netflix, but still, somebody's paying for Netflix.
They're paying $6 billion for content a year, which is, you know, they need to pay more and more, but that's at least some money.
And as far as Apple of finally agreeing to put Amazon's television app on its Apple TV, I would say, you know, there's the reason that's happening is because Apple actually needs something from Amazon, and that is they're going to sell this new speaker that's supposed to be, you know, in competition, frankly, with the Echo speaker that
the HomePod,
whatever it's called. I want to say this product is dead on arrival because it's really expensive and is really just a big giant speaker. But in any case, they're going to need somebody to sell that. They're going to need stores like Best Buy to sell it. They're going to need stores in around the world to sell it, but they're also going to need to sell it on Amazon, one of the world's largest online retailers. And so
they sell iPhones and tablets on Amazon.
They sell iPads, and I think they do sell iPhones on Amazon, although I could be wrong about that. But yeah, they sell certain products on Amazon. And I think this new product, this speaker, this HomePod, is one that you could sell on Amazon, unlike, say, a computer, or, you know, you could sell more of these HomePods than some of the other products Apple manufactures.
But do they sell Apple computers? And I did not know that. I didn't know that Apple products were sold on Amazon. They do.
Yeah.
MacBook Pro and all right.
Well, much like the watch, you know, they could probably...
That's sold on Amazon?
I don't know. Actually, I'm going to stop right there because I don't know what Apple products are sold on Amazon. I do know that this new product is one that you could sell on Amazon pretty easily.
I would like. Why would Amazon carry it?
Well,
they do sell the Apple Watch on Amazon. I can see that. But I'm not sure why Amazon would carry it. But the HomePod is... it's not clear.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, and, you know, we just mentioned Netflix and some of their series, but they're canceling series now. You know, they canceled Sense8 is a show that apparently a lot of people liked. There was a whole hashtag campaign. Renew Sense8 was the hashtag campaign. And you know, Netflix actually kind of came out and addressed them and said, look, to our Sense8 family, we've seen the petitions. We've read the messages. We know you want to hashtag Renew Sense8. And then they went on to say, but we're not going to do it. Okay, so we tried to figure out how to do it. It just doesn't make financial sense for us to do it, so we're sorry.
It just makes sense to, you know, address them and say, we heard you, we're sorry.
Right. Now, one thing that Taylor Swift did not want people to hear, apparently, was Katy Perry's new album. Okay, and that's what we're going to be talking about during Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We mentioned Taylor Swift. Why? Because Taylor Swift, her music has not been available on streaming services such as Spotify, I think it was available on Pandora, but on a lot of these streaming services, it was not available. But lo and behold, on Friday, she kind of said, look, to celebrate 10 million albums sold of her latest album, 1989, she's going to release all of her music on Spotify and all of these streaming services. I guess it only takes 10 million albums before you said, okay, I've made enough money. Everybody just, you know, go stream my music now.
Well, if you look at the Billboard charts, you can also see it's been 2.5 years since the album came out, and it's just at the bottom of the charts. It's like ranked 190 something or 189 out of 200. And in these days, when you can get in the top 10 selling 10,000 copies or the equivalent, you know that really is low down on the chart. So clearly album sales for 1989 are basically done.
Right. And so she's releasing her music to streaming services. She just happened to do it on the very same day that Katy Perry's new album, Witness, was, launched, released, not only to streaming services, but to record stores, if there are any left, on Amazon. And, of course, Taylor Swift stole all the headlines of her good friend, Katy Perry. And of course, I'm joking around. Apparently, there is a huge feud between Taylor Swift and Katy Perry, which I totally forgot about and actually didn't know about. And Bad Blood, apparently, the Taylor Swift song was written about Katy Perry. Who knew?
Well, I didn't know or care, and I was tempted to say that's ridiculous, but I guess the timing makes one say, well, there must be something to it, but who cares?
Well, what about Taylor Swift's music finally being available on streaming services? Does it matter? Well, I also think
that did make head. That did get a hit of attention on the entertainment world, and I think it's deserved. That, you know, if you're not there, you're not visible. So I think it's, you know, once you've gotten your album sales, I think you want your music on there just so people are listening to it. So I think that's the new world we're in. And I think streaming where it's at. And again, forget reporting album sales and equivalent. Just talk about streaming. Who's the biggest streaming artist of the week? Who's the biggest streaming album? Who's the biggest streaming song? That's what I want to know.
Well, if that's the case, then SiriusXM.
You know, because I beg your pardon, because they say in 1989 sold 10 million copies. What do they mean? I don't even know if I tried to find out. Did they mean it's actually sold 10 million copies, or has it been certified 10 times platinum equivalent? Like it sold 4 million copies and through all the streaming got the other 6 million copies. What's the deal? I don't even know what they mean when they say 10 million copies.
I can answer that question since none of her albums were available for streaming except on Apple Music. Remember the big kerfuffle when she...
I do, but yeah. Since some of them are available streaming on some sites and in the rest of the world, so I still don't know when I tried to look up, is that 10 million? I don't even know if you give an album a 10 million certification today, is that pure? It's not just pure sales anymore. So you can't know unless you go to the RIA and ask for a breakdown of what exactly they're claiming when they give it a 10 million certification. Maybe it only sold 8 million copies. We don't know. That's how they've debased the fact of sales by trying to pay attention to streaming. And it's absurd. Just celebrate streaming because that's its own new thing and that's the one that matters. So don't try to pretend it's a sale. Just celebrate it for what it is.
Well, streaming is what matters these days. No wonder SiriusXM, the satellite radio provider here in, I want to say North America. I think it's available in Canada as well. Could be wrong about that. They decided to invest $480 million in Pandora, one of the first streaming services that everybody knew about. And it looks like, I don't know, I guess Pandora was trying to sell itself. They had a deal with a private equity firm, and Pandora's pulling out of the deal with the private equity firm to take the $480 million from SiriusXM. The question is, why is SiriusXM investing in Pandora when they have their own streaming radio service?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah,
they are available in Canada, so I can answer that. But I have no idea why Sirius wants to invest $500 million in Pandora. Did the deals that they've cut with record labels, are they good enough that Sirius feels like, okay, now they're going to make money?
I don't know, but I know that, and I didn't look into this story beyond, you know, the headlines here, because I'm wondering, I know that SiriusXM is considered radio, and because of that, they get to pay just a portion of their revenue. I think it's like 8-10%. I'm sure I just got that wrong, but it's a certain percentage to license the music. Pandora, on the other hand, has been struggling with, are they a radio station? Are they streaming? What are they? And now all of a sudden they have deals with record labels that they can now stream, you know, on demand. So it's more like Spotify, whereas before it wasn't on demand. You just said, play me music like Katy Perry or Katy Perry. And then you got like a Katy Perry type radio station. Sometimes it played Katy Perry. Sometimes it played music that's like Katy Perry that wasn't Katy Perry at all.
But the main thing is that Pandora has not had a real business model. The more successful they are in an audience, the more money they have to pay out to labels, and they have not had a winning formula. And from what we can tell, they haven't really cracked that nut and lowered the rates of what they are paying to record labels so that they can make money. So I'm still not sure why Sirius said, hey, let's give them $500 million.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I'm wondering if there's some legal reasons and some licensing reasons that they did this. And
it won't cross over. They won't suddenly get a lower or higher rate for Pandora because 20% of it is owned by Sirius.
Yeah, and that's, by the way, that $480 million is only 20%. I do know that Pandora actually purchased a radio station in like Kansas or Iowa or someplace where they could then say, no, 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 we are just the streaming arm of this one radio station in Iowa. That didn't work too well for them either.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess I look at it this way. A lot of people are complaining about, you know, Pandora and the rates that Spotify pays. And these are businesses that are, they're startup businesses. Now, as you mentioned, Michael, it's been a while. They should be
startup. About 20% is $480 million. That's not a startup.
Well, right. Exactly. But, you know, I've been a part of many startup companies. And when you're a part of a startup company, you're always so, look, we got to pay less as an employee because, you know, we're trying to make money. We're trying to launch this business. Now, when you work for Google, it's no longer a startup. Okay. That's why you see people with, you know, multi-million dollar salaries coming out of Google and Yahoo and all these big companies. But when you're, you know, a startup and you've raised one or two rounds of capital, you know what? Yeah. Okay. You get paid less.
Because you get stock options.
Yeah. And that's the whole concept is that, look, if the business works, you'll be like a founding, employee. You'll strike it rich. And believe me, I know people who worked for Yahoo Movies back in the day before they went public. They don't even work anymore, okay? That's how wealthy they became by basically being an employee at a young startup company. But these companies like a Pandora or a Spotify, they're transitioning from being startups to, as you mentioned, Michael, multi-billion dollar companies. And they're going to have to start paying real prices for their product.
Start?
Well, exactly. And they're going to have to start paying real salaries, and they're going to have to start earning real revenue and real profit.
I don't know how to respond to that.
I think as people try and figure out how to go from being an emerging industry, the streaming music, to, okay, we actually have to be real now, I think companies like Sirius XM and Pandora, they're going to have to start looking at, okay.
Pandora's been around since 2000. It's 17 years.
Yes.
This is not a two-year-old company. It's a multi-billion dollar corporation. It's not a startup that's transitioning.
No, but it was only
transitioned. It's been 17 years. I don't know what you're talking about.
Pandora was never a streaming service in 2000. It was a...
But it began in 2000.
Yes, as the Music Genome Project. It was kind of like an experiment, right. And it was a science project. And around 2006, 2007...
A decade ago.
Yeah, is when they said, okay, well, maybe we can take that and turn this science experiment into something that actually streams
music.
It's
been a decade.
Yeah, and then probably about 3 years later, they went, oh, this could actually work. This could actually be a big deal. And then they were one of the first online streaming radio stations. But yeah, I mean, I would say there are a good 2008 is really when they started to kind of make themselves known as a streaming service. Yeah, but still, it's 9 years. Enough. You're a business now. And if you can't cut it, then you're going to have to figure out a way to cut it. Maybe teaming up with a competitor like SiriusXM might work.
All right. I don't know why Sirius is investing in them. I know why Pandora wants $500 million from Sirius.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know why Sirius wants to invest in them. Anyway.
I agree with that. I would agree with that one.
I don't know what you're talking about. We're going to have to start paying salaries. I'm sure a lot of people at Pandora make a good salary.
Yeah, I think we're vehemently agreeing with one another. Once again, I don't know why when we agree with one another, it sounds like we're killing each other. But speaking of killing each other, and maybe that's a bad segue, but that wraps up Inside Baseball.
That's a dreadful segue.
It is a dreadful segue. And that's probably why I'm not on Sirius XM.
That's all right. So it's time for the obituaries. As always, some people died, but Glenn Headley died unexpectedly. She's working on a new TV show. She died at 62, working actress. And she had a role in Lonesome Dove, the greatest miniseries of all time, according to some people. Certainly one of the greatest and most successful of all time. And Dick Tracy and lots of other properties. But she was a working actor, as was Adam West, the star of Batman. He died at 88. And he enjoyed a second life as a voiceover actor and having fun with the persona of Batman from the campy 1960s series. My favorite element about the death of Adam West was somebody tweeted, and our in-house film critic Aaron Rich sent this to me. Somebody tweeted that all the actors who've played Batman should show up at his funeral like former presidents do when a president dies. You know, she should have like all the, like Michael Keaton and George Clooney and Christian Bale. They should all show up somberly at his funeral. That's kind of awesome, I think. That's a very funny idea.
Yeah, there's very few people.
And he would love it.
Yeah, that's true, actually. He didn't necessarily appreciate the darker Batmans. He was called the Bright Knight instead of the Dark Knight. There's very few people who understand the what it's like to wear the cape.
Yes, exactly. So that's a funny idea. It'd be nice if they did it. I'm sure it won't happen, but it's a fun idea.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think certainly for myself and for many other than the comic books, when it came to the motion pictures and television, Adam West was the first person playing Batman that we associated with the role. And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, it kind of did his career a disservice because he could never be unassociated from it. It took him years to get back into any type of acting that was serious. And even then, it wasn't his career kind of always revolved around Batman. And eventually he just said, look, I guess if that's going to be it, then I'm going to have to embrace it.
I think the idea that he would have had some big career if he hadn't done Batman is putting the cart before the horse. He was lucky to have one iconic role. Whether he lost out on some tons of other stuff, I doubt it. You know, it's not like I look at him and think, oh, what a brilliant actor that was hobbled by this fame. It's like, no, you know, he got lucky. He was in a thing that people still would talk about. And ultimately, happily, he said, okay, that's a good thing. I'll relax and enjoy it.
Yes, kind of like you should be relaxing and enjoying our show, which you can subscribe to in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our show. You can rate and review it in those podcasts.
Not that aggregates. You have.
Well, wait a second. What do you mean not that they have?
They need to rate and review the show. They haven't done it.
Yes. Well, you know, please do rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do. You can also, well, I guess, look. If you go to any one of those podcast aggregators, or maybe your preferred podcast aggregator, and you can't find Showbiz Sandbox there, let us know. Write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. All of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something I look forward to. It's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it is PandoraIsNotAStartup.com.
That's true, .com. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to TheHuffingtonPost.com or MichaelGiltz.com is where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.